وظل المصطفى المختار الحبيب الذي كان فجرا لذاته ينتظر سفينته في مدينة أورفيليس من كتاب النبي جبران.
Hello and welcome to the Shakti Hour podcast on Ram Dass's Be Here Now Network. I'm your host, Melanie Moser, and today we continue our Shakti Sacred Music series, conversations with musicians about sacred music and the feminine voice. My guest is Kaveh Nabatian, filmmaker and musician and trumpet player in the band Bell Orchest. Kaveh and I met many years ago and have been in and around each other's lives ever since. I find him to be an incredibly inspiring artist and musician and traveler of the globe and speaker of many languages. So it was really a treat to get to sit with him and talk about spirituality and music. He brought in a piece by Lebanese singer Fairuz, and we got into some interesting insights around communal experience of music and how that itself can be a spiritual practice. I hope that you're enjoying the series and you're sharing it with your friends. Please remember to subscribe to the Shakti Hour on iTunes and leave us a rating and review. You can also follow along at ShaktiSacredMusic.com, where you'll find the full songs of the music featured on the Sacred Music series, including music from the guests in their personal projects, and more information on the spiritual paths of both the featured artists and Shakti Hour guests. You can also join in at Shakti Hour Patreon page to become a subscriber and have access to the unedited interviews in this series. As always, everything can be found at the BeHereNowNetwork.com Shakti Hour page. And thank you so much for listening. What do you have queued up for us to listen to?
So we're going to listen to Fairuz off the album The Legendary Fairuz, and it's a live version of the song Beirut al-Zarafat. There's a lot of radio stations that the first thing they play every day is a Fairuz song or an Umm Kulthum song. And there are Fairuz in particular, her voice is super beautiful and really speaks to me. And I think is really interesting is that she sang about the Arabic world. So despite the fact that she was Lebanese, she would sing about Egypt, and like she has a song about Egypt and a song about, you know, Beirut and a song about Kuwait. And so she had this kind of thing where she'd bring together all the Arabic world, despite all of its, you know, problems and interfighting and stuff, as this, like, with this idea of this, like, one kind of people and this one kind of music. There's something about the way the music functions to allow that female voice to soar with all of this power that that's kind of like opens this gate for these women to, like, you know, just kind of let loose with this, like, emotion and ferocity that I find really fascinating.
And you say that the radio stations play that first in the day?
Yeah, you know, like after the call to prayer, famously there's one, I think it's, you know, one of the big stations in Beirut, like for the last, whatever, 40 years, has played a Fairuz song first thing after the first call to prayer. It's like how people start their day. And same with Kulthum and other radio stations. I think there's kind of somewhat of a rivalry between the two of them. But Fairuz's voice is far more, like Kulthum is really intense and kind of harsh and definitely worth listening to. Fairuz is more kind of emotional, and there's a certain elegance to it, but it still sounds very much like, you know, it's not like elegant in a European way. It's elegant in an Arabic way.
And what does she sing about?
Well, that's it. I don't really speak Arabic, but she sings. I mean, a lot of the songs, I don't know really how heavy the lyrics are. I think it's a lot about the experience of living in the Middle East and of being an Arab in the Middle East, and kind of like about how great Kuwait is and how great Beirut is. And, you know, I think it's a lot about, like, although she also sings some stuff based on Khalil Gibran, I don't know actually how you pronounce that, based on the prophet. So there's, you know, she also has certain things that are based on spiritual writing.
Yeah.
I don't even know if she writes her own songs. I just love the sound of her voice. And when I was in Egypt and Jordan a few years ago, it was like wherever I went, you know, people were always a little suspicious of, like, he was this white dude. What's he doing here? Because I like to get into, like, kind of unusual places. But I would always have my little Bluetooth speaker with me, and I just put on Feruz because it just made so much sense there. And as soon as people heard Feruz, they were my best friend, because I was like, okay, you get us if you like Feruz. You
know? I see. But the call said that the call to prayer is men singing.
Yeah. And definitely. And theoretically, they're not, it's not singing, you know, it's not right. It's supposed to be art. But I mean, yeah, I'm really not an expert on Feruz or about on Arabic music, really. But it, for me, it was just, I heard this when I was in Egypt, and it just blew my mind open. There's something about her voice. And there's, you know, like, I'm of Persian descent, which is in a lot of ways very far from the Arabic world, but also it's right next to it, you know? Mm. So there's something about those orchestrations and those scales that they're using, those modes, that speaks to me very, very much. But it doesn't sound like Persian music. So it, you know, just kind of turned my ear onto to a new sound.
Yeah.
Pretty cool song. Yeah.
Did anybody give you a cue into why that's like the start after prayer?
Well, I think the idea is that it's, I don't know that it's related to the call to prayer per se. It's more related to, like, how do you want to start your day? You want to start your day with Feruz. You know, it's like, it's just a good way to start anything. Is,
right.
Is Feruz. Is it? Yeah. And it's that feeling of, yeah, of like this kind of unity across countries that I think is, or across cultures, to me anyway, that's what it seems like is, to me anyway, that is what it seems like is the most, as an outsider, the strongest thing, is that whether I was in Egypt or Jordan, who historically have a lot of rivalries, you put on Feruz and people go nuts. And including, like, I went into the south of Egypt where it's Nubian, so, you know, black Egyptians, and they're seen as, you know, dirty by Northern Egyptian. There's like a whole, you know, there's a lot of racial issues in Egypt. And whether it's Coptic Christians or Nubians or Arab Egyptians, Feruz is like this binding force. And there's something about that. Like, I don't know. They'd be like, I don't know. It'd be like if every day everyone listened to Elvis in the morning or something. I mean, but across cultures too. Or, you know, like, I don't think we really have that. And maybe the Beatles in Europe, but even then still there's so much division between different countries and in the cultures, you know, like, I don't know if Hungarians probably were listening to the Beatles all the time, but you know what I mean? It's like, there's this kind of thing about this pan Arabic experience that seems that I find really interesting.
I can see why it would be the way to start your day, because it's this, it's like a gentle little river lifting you into the flow of your life.
Yeah. And another thing that I think is really interesting about her is that, I mean, aside from like the very intro and the very outro of that song in particular, that bum, 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 like it's like this kind of march thing.
Yeah.
But then once it gets going, there's something that's quite mournful about it, but it's not sad mournfulness. You know, it's like, it, there's a, I mean, it, it's partly just that mode, that, that scale that they're using sounds like in quotations, sad to the Western ear. But there's also her voice, you know, like she sings super loudly and super quietly in that, but there's so much vocal control. And it's also, there's always this kind of like, I guess plaintive more than mournful. There's this like kind of, I feel like there's this kind of like cry out to me in it. I don't know if you were getting that at all.
Well, it, I get it, but it wasn't what I thought it was going to be.
Right.
And I think that that's where I was like really like working harder than I needed to listening to it. I could feel that
mm-hmm.
kind of tension of the bandwidth kind of crunched in there,
mm-hmm.
but she's such an expert
mm-hmm.
that it almost made me uncomfortable. Because it wasn't really expressing that feeling,
right?
You know?
Yeah.
And so the context that you gave it with the, you know, the culture, and then the space that it sits in the day,
yeah,
and the way that you would get like an instant street cred for for having that as part of your listening, It didn't make me sad, but it almost made me curious about, you know, what she does when she's off duty.
Mm.
Like, because that's such an expert dial
mm-hmm.
of emotion, an expert dial of restraint. I mean, in the vocal control, like you said, is bananas.
Yeah.
Because you could be having that call out of you, like that mode, could call out of you, you know. And I'm thinking to the female cantor that we listened to in one of the first episodes, like those are some really crazy modes and scales that are in there, but there's the whole thing is moved by emotion. The whole thing is moved by feeling.
Yeah.
And this is that, like,
yeah.
And like, put in this way.
Yeah.
Where I can't wait to listen to it again. I can't wait to listen to more, really, and like feel out, like find the feeling of it.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting to me, like at one point I considered looking up the lyrics, but I chose not to because I kind of don't really want to know, because it works on its own to me. So I don't know really what the emotional content is supposed to be of what, you know, what she's, I know that she's saying about Beirut. Imagine it's something, you know, about how beautiful and it is and how sad the sad things are and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But the way that music functions to me, the fact that there's such an intricate interplay between the voice and the orchestra, but it's clear that the orchestra is there purely to service the voice, to create a space for the voice to do what it does. Is really interesting to me, because in another kind of music, you know, you could take the vocal out, especially in like one of these chorus, verse chorus bridge things, and it's like, oh, that's the instrumental of the Blonde Redhead song or the Beatles song, and it wouldn't work as well without the voice, but it would still work.
Right.
This kind of music is the orchestration is much more intense than it often would be in like Western pop music, but it is only there to serve the voice. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Got it. Right. Because it is like the same. Like they're the same.
Yeah.
They're not, one is, they're mixed. They're kind of running right alongside of one another.
Exactly. Yeah.
Except that this powerful, however many piece orchestra is in service to the voice completely.
Yeah.
Because there was no like instrumental section of.
Well, I mean, there are little bits that are instrumental,
right.
But it's kind of like the whole purpose of them is so that when she comes in even harder. You know
right.
what I mean?
And how does that like fit in terms of the your vibe. I know this isn't your personal spiritual path, but how does it fit in terms of the vibe of what you see as the spiritual or cultural, or what you experienced as the spiritual or cultural overtones of where you heard it? Like, do you see it having, I mean, it already has this placement in relationship to the call to prayer, but how does it relate spiritually?
Well, I think that, and this isn't really only, you know, limited to the Arabic world, but people, I think a lot of the function of music is to provide a spiritual escape from, you know, day-to-day life. And the reality is that, especially in a place like Beirut that had, you know, went through so much war and all this stuff, or the Arabic world in general, the Middle East in general, it's never been an easy place, even, you know, for ever, you know? So I think that this kind of music, it's so dreamy and so beautiful that it creates this place to escape from your daily troubles. And I, you know, and that makes it sound like it's almost like reductive, but I think that's such an important thing, is to be able to like go into this really beautiful place. And it's not like you're, I mean, not that there's anything wrong with listening to top 40 dance music to escape, but this space that she creates is this very particular space, and the idea that everyone kind of goes into this space together, I think, has a spiritual dimension to it.
Right. And that it isn't religious per se.
Right.
That it is this complement to that, adds another level of spirituality to it, because it's for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that it's for Christian Copts and, you know, Arab, like Muslim Arab, it's not limited by culture or religion, but it creates this, I mean, I think when music functions at its best, it creates a spiritual space for people to go to get together. But like with someone like my band, realistically, nobody is, the kind of people who are going to listen to my music, whether I like it or not, are all kind of the same, you know, like they're hipstery, like people who like weirdo, cool music.
Yeah.
It's not like I'm appealing to, I mean, we were talking about the difference between bi-coastal people and Midwestern people, like how there's this big difference. Like people in the Midwest mostly aren't listening to my music. Whereas the equivalent with Feruz is like people who are poor and people who are super rich and people who are educated and uneducated, all of them are listening to her. And that, there's something very unifying about that, I think.
Right. Right. Having a secular, unifying spiritual experience is something really cool. Like you said, I mean, that's, and that it's a woman's voice, especially in that culture, is really deep.
Yeah. And in a culture where women's voices aren't often heard in the public sphere, that the most public voices musically that we hear are women's voices, I think it speaks to the fact that their voices aren't necessarily heard in the public sphere as often.
Right.
I mean, not to in any way imply that women in the Middle East are not strong, because they're like the strongest women I've ever met, but like you don't necessarily, at least in certain countries, they're not at the forefront of politics or at the forefront, you know, then there's a lot of repression and all this stuff. And the fact that it's Feruz and Umm Kulthum every morning and just blasting out, and every night, I mean, it's everywhere. You hear it just everywhere.
Right.
Yeah.
I feel like that could be really valuable for us, you know, to have culturally integrated spiritual experiences and you know, like I think of Sesame Street in the U.S., the television show. I don't even know. Do you know Sesame Street?
Yeah, no, we haven't yet.
I think of that coming out of the 60s, which is this moment that I consider to be this time when there was a counterculture spiritual moment, right? That then entered into the cultural, mainstream cultural landscape through these different things. So like Sesame Street was this place where a lot of us got kind of the remnants of that moment, which was counterculture, right? It still wasn't mainstream, right? Which is something that I was talking to some of the Ram Dass Satsang about a month ago, and they were pointing out to me, they're like, yeah, but they thought we were like clowns, like, you know, in that time. They're like the acid-taking hippies. They thought, like, mainstream culture thought we were like clowns and like goofballs.
Right.
And now, it's just now that this has become like, that yoga and Ram Dass and mindfulness and this stuff is now in a mainstream level.
Right.
But I think that there's some value in having good spiritual ideas embedded in culture. And so this is kind of almost the inverse of it in that the spiritual quote unquote values in this culture are hammered in, like they're built in.
Right.
Right. And then this is kind of the, I don't want to make a commentary on religion, but this is kind of the thing that I'm talking about,
right,
like coming in around that. It's like, okay, we did the prayer. We have our organized society.
Yeah.
We have all these restrictions. Now here's this moment where we all join the flow together. That's so cool.
Yeah.
But, you know, how to get it, how to get that, like you said, people, I mean, what, when you're talking about your music, you're talking about Bell Orchestre?
Yeah.
So,
Or other stuff that I've done.
Yeah. Yeah. So, like, how to get that level of awareness across America and to turn people on. That would be kind of cool.
Yeah, it'd be amazing. I don't know if it's possible. I mean, I guess there's Beyonce. I think everybody likes Beyonce, even in the Midwest, right? Or maybe not.
Maybe, you know.
I don't know anything about the Midwest, so I can't I can't comment on that. And I mean, and she's talking about important stuff, but it's more political. There's something about the fact that the music, like Feruz, I mean, I'm sure a lot of it is political. Again, I'm kind of talking out of my ass because I don't really know what she's singing about. But from the reactions I got to playing and from the way people were listening to it, it's not hammering, it's not propaganda, it's not pro one party or not against another party. It's like creating this, it's about creating a space for everyone to get into together. And I don't know what the equivalent even could be in Western pop music or Western music period, you know.
Right. I mean, it doesn't even really lend itself to that because, you know, the ABABCABA structure kind of holds you to a storyline or something, and like a major minor chord setup is going to dictate your experience. I mean, if you're in a major C G D situation, you're creating one emotion. If you're in a minor, you're creating another.
Yeah.
This is vast.
Yeah.
You can really source yourself in it.
Yeah. Well, to me, it's not unrelated also to like the modal music of the 50s and 60s and jazz. You know, like if you listen to Kind of Blue or whatever, it's kind of the same thing. Like the band's laying down this, it's almost like slowly shifting tectonic plates is how I think of it. You know, it's like these like slowly moving chord structures, but they're not jumping all over the place the way they had been earlier in jazz. And then Miles's trumpet can soar over it or, you know.
Right. And in that way, that's like a really beautiful testament to like the individual and the group. So tell me a little bit about your own relationship to spirit and music. I know a little bit about your personal spiritual religious upbringing, but how does this whole thing sit with you? Like this idea of sacred music or spiritual music or that holding that.
Well, for me, I mean, I think really all music is sacred, and it's just a question of whether you name it or not. And I think that often when you do name it, it brings a certain amount of intensity and energy to the music. But I think at the end of the day, that's what it all is about, is creating these sacred spaces. And when you're playing music well, it's when you're getting out of the way of the sacred to blow through you. You know, it's not, you're not really, I don't believe that you're ever really creating it. And if you are creating it, you're probably not playing very good music. Do you know what I mean? Like it's, I often think of it like a vocal cord. Like if you don't breathe through your vocal cords, you can't make any sound. The vocal cords are your own, but the breath is God. The breath is the spirit. It's the universe.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I think the goal is to get your technique up to whatever level you can, and then to just get out of the way so that the spirit can take the music where the spirit wants to go. And if it's chosen you to do that, it's choosing you to do it in your particular way, you know, like, so not that all music, like, not that the same spirit would say the same thing through two different people. I think that they choose which person they're going to blow their music through. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Who's they?
The spirit? They're the spirits. Yeah.
Right.
The spirits, God, the universe, whatever people are calling it these days.
Right. Well, I mean, I do think it's worth it to say, you know, first you said God, you said the breath, you said spirit, then you said multiple spirits, then you said they. And I think that there's a lot to that, honestly, in terms of religious belief and like where that belief comes from. Can you say more about where your flexibility around that language comes from?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I grew up Unitarian, which is like, someone called it the pescatarians of of religion, where you can kind of believe in God if you want, but you don't have to, and you learn a lot about a lot of different religions. So I think I grew up like kind of aware of a bigger spirit than what was going on in that church, but I didn't really have a place to put it. And then my brother and I became introduced to Sufism in a very powerful way. And he went on to study Sufism and divinity school at Harvard and become a Sufi chaplain. And like Sufism is that really like took over his life in a lot of ways. He married the only other Sufi at Harvard, which was at the time that he was there, which I think is really cute. And it also took me on quite a journey, although I didn't convert or anything. But then soon after I was introduced to Sufism, I went to Africa and was spending a lot of time in Senegal, and in Senegal they have a kind of Sufism called the Bifals, and I spent a lot of time at Bifal things and learning Bifal rhythms and all this kind of stuff. And there they, you know, everyone was trying to get me to convert, something didn't feel quite right. And then I was in Cuba researching a film about an Afro-Cuban ballet dancer, and so one of the things I needed to learn about was his relationship to spirituality. And so I wanted to learn about Santeria. So I met a cab driver who was also a Babalao, which is, I guess, like a Santeria priest. And I went and hung out with him, and he did a reading for me. And the reading was like spot on. It was really weird. And he encouraged me to become initiated. And I was like, there's something about those Cuban rhythms and that culture that really I was drawn to. So, and I was, you know, I was like, well, what the hell? So I became initiated into Santeria, which was extremely intense. And in Santeria, you've got, as in like Haitian voodoo and Brazilian candomblé, you've got all these different deities that represent different forces, you know? So like Chango is the god of fire and lightning. Oya is the goddess of change and wind and shooting stars. Oshun is the goddess of fertility and rivers and honey and all this stuff. You know, it goes on forever. It's not unlike other pantheons of Greek mythology or the Native American or whatever. And so I've, you know, as someone who's initiated, I have to do certain things for my orishas, they're called. And those rituals keep me in touch with that religion. But because I also like took this big detour via Sufism, I'm really quite convinced that it's all the same, you know? And like, I think for me, the important thing is to be doing something and to have some sort of, for me, that rituals are actually quite important, and it doesn't really matter which one you choose, because it's the ritual that keeps you in touch with that spirit or those spirits. And I think Like, I don't really think there is a dude named Elegua at every crossroad helping me to make decisions, but I believe in the spirit of Elegua, and I believe that like spending time praying to Elegua or doing a sacrifice for Elegua or whatever can help open doors or help me understand what to do at a crossroads. And I also don't believe that there's like some dude in the sky with a big beard named God, but but there's things about Christianity that I think are super beautiful, and when you meet really Christians who are deep into it and in a really beautiful, pure way, I mean, you can feel the light emanating from them. And so I for me, there's really no hierarchy between the religions. I think that when you tap in, everyone's tapping into the same spirit or spirits, and it's just kind of how the nomenclature changes from one to another.
The spirit or spirits makes sense to me now, because we're talking about, when you say it multiple, it's multiple from the one through the different access points.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, great.
So then I was just kind of searching a bunch, and then when I found the Bifals in Senegal, I was, you know, really excited about it, and then felt those same feelings again. But there's just something, you know, I feel like you know where you're supposed to go somewhere inside you, and it's like, well, I'm not...
Spiritually.
Yeah, like I don't... Yeah. It's like I'm not going to move to Senegal and become a Bifal realistically. Like, am I going to convert to Islam? I don't know. This doesn't... There's something about that didn't quite make sense, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But that whole experience really turned me on to the idea of spirituality and religion. And I mean, I'd always thought that stuff was important, and I'd always kind of known it was out there, but I needed something to latch onto in order to do it. Like, you know, you have to meditate every day if you want to get, if meditation is important. You can't just think meditation's a cool idea and never do it.
Right.
You know, and so
the Unitarian experience that I had adjacent to you when mm-hmm. we first met, what I got from the Unitarian Universalists was community, was acceptance, was open-mindedness, was open-heartedness, which was like just basic goodness and decency to other human beings. That's all I took from that. Was that the foundation, or was there other spiritual principles that were put into your mind then? I mean, were you set on a path to look for a place to sink your teeth in, or were you just offered that and then you as an individual were looking for some place to sink your teeth in?
I mean, I think it set the groundwork to be interested, because it's, you know, it's a very kind of in general intellectual kind of religion, in that it brings people together, like you say, in community. And sometimes it feels more like a really nice community activity than a religion. But when, you know, like, for example, when you go to Sunday school, instead of like being hammered over the head with a Bible, one of the classes was called Holidays and Holy Days. And every Sunday we'd learn about a holy day from a different religion, which is like the opposite of what most religions do, you know?
Right.
And it becomes kind of like, to me, felt like kind of an intellectual pursuit, but an interesting one. It's almost like going to a lecture or a class, but it did make me be interested and aware that there was a lot of different ways of looking at the idea of spirituality. And so in that way, it probably opened me to it, but I don't know that it would open another Unitarian to it. You know what I mean?
Right. Because you could just go along. I mean, as with anybody plugged into any religious system, you can just kind of go along with the thing. Or you're an artist, you're drawn to music, and you're going to tune into these different things as you're being kind of taught.
Yeah.
That there's possibility out there.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, great. That's helpful. So, yeah, because I mean, in my Sunday school, it was very, very much I was learning exactly what I was supposed to learn, right?
Yeah.
And what the story was. And also, I remember, I was just remembering this the other day. We were in a church, I guess I must have been like a preteen, and we had moved churches, and the pastor was really, really, really strict. His name was Noel Vold, and he still wore like horn rim glasses and had like greased hair.
Buzz cut, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I remember him. I remember like challenging something he said, like innocently, I had this memory of saying, well, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, and just getting totally shut down, you know, completely shut down. And then we ended up moving churches, and I started playing in like the Lutheran church band at this more like liberal church, and like started listening to U2 and was like, you know, open to possibilities. Anyway, so that's a little bit different. You know, it took me a little longer to find the freedom to explore things. And even when I was in India, however many years ago, 6 years ago, I still was struck by my resistance to, like, ingrained resistance, not actual Melanie's resistance, but like to, you know, worshiping idols.
Right.
So what I really liked about what you said about practicing ritual as a way that the ritual is actually important to having access to keeping that doorway open. So tell me about, what is this thing that you got initiated into?
Santeria is the, it's the main religion of Afro-Cuban people, but like not only Afro-Cubans, many Cubans, I mean, it's the majority of Cubans are Santeria practitioners. And it was like, it was held underground for a lot of time under Fidel. And then at a certain point in the late 80s, Fidel said people are allowed to be Santeros. And then all of a sudden you could just see it everywhere, what had been underground. But it's the same kind of, a lot of the same people who ended up in Haiti and in Brazil, like is it from Yoruba people. And so they all have their own kind of idea of what, it breaks down in different ways in these different cultures. But, you know, like in Haiti, there's Papa Legba, who deals with crossroads. And then in Cuba, his name is Elegua. So even, you know, so you can really see the, or is Yemaya in Cuba is the goddess of the ocean. And in Cuba, it's, and in Brazil, it's Yemenje. You know what I mean? So you can see it's like the same, it's like an ancient religion. And in Nigeria, it's still practiced as well. And the slaves brought it over, and their gods became syncretized with the Catholic gods, the Christian gods. And so the feast days for the different Christian saints they'd celebrate their, you know, their own Orisha at the same time.
Just under the cover of,
yeah,
of whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Saint holiday.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, Saint holiday. And I can't remember how they're all syncretized, but each, you know, every one of the Santeria Orishas has a saint, a Christian saint attached to it.
Oh, interesting. What's the underlying principle or what drew you in? I mean, what made you went on this journey, and then this guy was like, I want to initiate you, and you were like, oh yeah, okay. How did you know that was the one for you? Was it that the moment in your life, or was it like the feeling after having sampled these different experiences around the globe, that what turned you on, what made you know it was time?
Yeah, no, I think that, I mean, it's a really good question. I think it was partly having sampled different ideas. I was like, well, you just got to do one. And this one's being presented to you. And I think there's a bunch of stuff. I think that I've had issues around fear and fighting fear my whole life, despite the fact that from the outside, it doesn't look like I live a fearful existence. I've often been scared of stuff. And there's something about when this guy presented this idea, I was like, all right, I mean, what's the worst that could happen? And now, I mean, it's funny because the worst thing that could happen in that religion is, and that's an exaggeration, but religion is a funny place to mess around with, like being, like, I feel like I have to take care of my stuff in the Santeria world now, or bad stuff could happen, you know, like, whereas like going bungee jumping is like, you're either dead or you did it, and then it's over, you know? I probably should have just gone bungee jumping, but no, actually it's been really nice. You know, like I travel a lot, and so I have to do certain things before I travel or when I get back. And it's very like grounding, and it makes me think, you know, like when I'm praying to Elegua, who is the god of the crossroads, I think about where I am and what are the crossroads I'm going to have to like cross in the next while, and how do I want to do it? And so it becomes a little bit less just constantly reactive, you know. And I think there's a lot of different ways you could get to that kind of more meditative state of mind. It could be through meditation, or it could be through therapy. But in this case, the religion has been helpful for me to, and there's like, it also just like aesthetically works for me, you know, like the music. Each one of the orishas has a really intense trance-inducing rhythm. Huh. And the candles and the squash and the honey and the whole thing just kind of works for me. It just makes sense to me somehow.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit more about this fear thing. What does that mean to you to deal with fear? Because it's true, you know, I know you. You travel the world. You create things. You seem to do what's before you without hesitation. So I think it's helpful to share what fear means to you, what the experience of fear is.
Mm. Well, I think if I'm honest, a lot of the things I've done in my life have been in reaction to fear, but they weren't necessarily things that came to me naturally. It was like, okay, I'm scared of this. I have to prove to myself that I can do it. And I've had a bunch of times where I've frozen, you know, like I remember once when I was younger, I was skiing down this slope and it was like too steep and I just froze, and because I got scared and I smashed into a tree and got a concussion, and people were like, I don't know what happened. You were going fine and then you just stopped. And I think it's partly that. It's just like, I gotta never stop when I'm scared. And I think, you know, that, and then you kind of fake it till you make it. Yeah, I was traveling a lot, and then partly to prove to myself that I could, and then it just became my way of living. And but, you know, I think I've had massive fear still. Like, I'm 42 and I'm making my first feature film. I think I could have, it was always easy to explain reasons why I wasn't doing it before, but it was also because I was terrified. And now that I'm shooting it in 6 weeks, I'm like super terrified, but it's too late to stop. So I'm doing it, and I'm like, got my orishas going, and they're all hopefully going to help me out with this. And, you know.
Right. Right. So I'm kind of connecting it. It's kind of looping around for me now in listening to the music that we had at the beginning and how that is integrated into the day.
Mm.
And how kind of gentle and like you the space, it's not a womb mm. thing, but it is like a little bit of a kind of a laying out of an entrance into the day.
Right.
So I'm just tapping into this idea of like, what is the feeling of fear? Like, I got the frozen thing on the ski slope.
Mm-hmm.
That's like a dropping away of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
and agency.
Right.
So what does it mean to be in fear?
Mm. I mean, I think that stuff is tied to insecurity a lot. You know, like, I was afraid to commit to relationships. I was afraid to commit to making the movie. I was afraid to commit to a religion. I was just like, so it wasn't like I was sitting at home being scared of, you know, ghosts or whatever. It was more just like I had a fear of committing to my own life, I think.
Huh.
And so, you know, becoming initiated was like, well, I'm committing to this thing now and I have to do it. And so that opened certain doors for me.
That for me is definitely my experience of a spiritual life, is developing that personal relationship with spirit and that commitment, which is then to the self, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, to your own light and your own life.
Yeah.
And so what's so beautiful about Feroz, am I saying that right?
Feroz, yeah.
Feroz, sorry, is that she is, you know, kind of doing that culturally for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So in a place where there's not a lot of choice, there's people that are going to be able to get that from that religious practice. And then there's offering you that space to remember.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and offering a space for a community to join together and live an experience together. You know, like musicians are basically priests. They're like shaman, you know, or shawwomen, whatever they're called. And I think I can think of so many different kinds of musical experiences I've had, whether it's like electronic music or music in Morocco or in Cuba or in whatever, where it's not about, and where the music is really filtering through some priest or priestess, and everyone's gathered around and feeling it. And it feels like, you know, like what you hear about old crazy, you know, in medieval England or ancient England, all these druids with their like raves and stuff. Like, it's just, it's a need that humans have. It's really easy to see how it's done in traditional cultures, but I think we're doing it all the time here. Like people, I just got tickets for the Massive Attack show in Radio City Music Hall, and they sold out in 20 minutes. Like, there's a reason for that. It's not because it's because they're cool or whatever, but it's because everyone wants to experience this feeling together and to like worship together. Not that you're worshiping those guys, but to like come to a higher plane or a different plane of existence and all together as one people. You know, otherwise you just sit at home and listen to the record on your headphones.
Right. The communal experience is part of what makes it sacred.
Absolutely. For me anyway, I mean, I'm sure that there's also then, you know, what Thomas Merton, the you know, he would just go off and be totally alone and have his sacred moments. Like, I don't think it's necessary. I think different people are different. And I think that solitude is a big part of spirituality. But I also think that a community of people praying in some way together, even if praying just means dancing together, is also a very sacred experience.
Yeah. Tell me one more thing about your personal experience with sound and the spirit. Or God or the spirits?
Well, what comes up when you say that is, you know, I haven't been practicing enough, and it's really sad because I'm making this movie and it's making me crazy. But when I'm in shape on my instrument and I'm playing with other people, there's this moment where I just switch off and it just happens. And I think that's pretty much the best feeling in the world, you know, like, and then, you know, you look at the people who can achieve those heights all the time, and it's just like, I'm so inspired by them. And you look at the jazz dudes who are, I think there's so much heroin partly because that feeling of you've like woodshedded your ass off and you're an amazing instrumentalist, but then you can just put it all aside and just let the spirit enter you and play. Like, it's totally pure catharsis, you know, it's like better than any drug. And then you go back to your crappy apartment and your promoter steals your money. And of course you're going to start doing heroin because normal life can't compare to that feeling. And I haven't had that many, you know, like maybe I've had like probably less than 100 if I'm honest. But I can like remember where I was, and I can, and you know, it's, for me, it starts to become very visual. Like, I stop really hearing that as music, and just like kind of these like shapes and colors start happening. And it's just like, and then if, of course, as soon as I'm like, whoa, those are cool shapes and colors, it's over. They snap out of it. But those little moments where the music is just happening and everyone's together. And I think for me, for sure, that's communal. Like, you know, I've like recorded music on my own with multi-track stuff and whatever. It never happens. It's when there's a bunch of people together, there's no ego, and there's a lot of listening, and everyone's just letting the spirit flow through them. It's like, that's the best. Like, that's the reason to live. You know?
Right. Yeah, that's the reason to live. And that is, I mean, that's what a meditative experience is. I mean, that's what you're doing. You're putting in the time, you're sitting on your cushion to the moment where you are in samadhi, where you are in that place.
Yeah.
And then, like you said, as soon as you're like, oh, I'm not thinking, I'm in a timeless space.
Yeah. Yeah, it's,
you're
over.
Right back.
Yeah.
Right. And so you go back to that practice to find that. And that's, you know, that's part of, you know, I know people have these ideas of meditation, and it does take some time, but it doesn't take that much time. to get to where you can actually have that experience through that practice mm-hmm. too, you know? And I feel like as a musician, you kind of get, not a pass, but like a kind of a bonus because you do get to have that experience, especially mm-hmm. if you're doing improvised music or mm-hmm. if you're playing with other people and you do put in the time. But I know, you know, it's like so much of what you're saying is the ritual, is the practice, mm-hmm. is of putting in that time so that you can have the space to receive that gift.
Yeah, totally.
And to be in that flow and that effort to do that. And to someone like Farouz, that is so, there's so many chops in that. There's not a single bow
yeah.
out of order. And her voice is so controlled
yeah.
that, you know, there's so much discipline
yeah.
and effort put into that transmission being allowed to come through you.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know... what you said about the heroin, I thought you were leading to saying that then people, my assumption was that people would take that drug to then get out of the way to then, while they were playing, to allow.
Well, I think that happens too. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I wasn't around, but I don't know. I've heard different stories about whether those guys were high when they were playing or whether they were at their best when they were high. You know, I think a lot of it was to relieve the pressure of the shitty lives that they were leading outside of that space. But I'm sure there's also a lot of great high playing going on. I have no idea.
But that's, you know, that's like a whole other thing, which is that, like, you know, okay, so I don't know how much you know about Ram Dass, but, you know, he and Tim Leary were at Harvard. They took LSD. They were like, holy crap. We just learned more in like, well, they took psilocybin. They're like, we just learned more in like a weekend than we did in all of our doctorate studies of psychology about the human mind and the human experience. Right. They went on this path. They had Millbrook. They took hundreds, thousands hits of acid. They did days and days of rotating. These people are tripping and these people aren't. These people are tripping. These people aren't.
Sounds exhausting.
Yeah. But the thing was, but Ram Dass's story, Richard Alpert's story, is that he was like, wait, I always come down. Like, there has to be a way to stay in this place. Like, why do I have to come down and crash and have this horrible crash? Sends him on his journey to India, yada yada, meets our guru, Maharaji, Neem Karoli Baba. And then the practice of love and service comes in. And that's how you stay high.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
But that's a practice, right? Of surrender and of loving and serving and remembering God.
Mm-hmm.
This back to your thing about fear and the practice of ritual, like you have to show up, do the ritual, and keep moving through it, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Practicing kind of sucks, but you got to do it for whether it's meditation or music or religion or whatever. I think that's part of it.
Right. And that's but you know, to your point about your focus is now turned on this new film that you're working on. So this practice that you have of playing trumpet is like
weak currently.
It's currently weak.
Yeah.
Which creates though the longing
mm-hmm.
for that.
Yeah.
Which is also a part of it. And who knows, like maybe you'll find that space in a new way through making this feature film.
Film doesn't do it though, really.
No.
film's amazing. I love it, but it doesn't do that same. You know, like Nietzsche and Schopenhauer talk about music as the sovereign art, and I think that's absolutely correct. I think with everything else you're trying to do, you're making a measurement of an idea, whereas music is the pure idea. You know what I mean?
Mm.
So I just got to get back at it. But you know, I just go in cycles. With my band, we just finished a new album, and I was sounding okay on that, so I'm not too worried.
Tell me about that. So Bell Orchestre has a new album.
Bell Orchestre just mastered a new album, and it won't be out for another almost a year, I don't think.
Oh.
But yeah, it's pretty cool. It's one song.
Oh, really?
It's a 140-minute song album. And it goes to a lot of, it journeys to a lot of different places, and it's all based on improvised music, but it's not all improvised.
And then what else is going on? You're working on this feature,
right?
Which is being shot
in Havana and Montreal.
In Havana and Montreal. And when do you start that?
On January 9th.
January 9th.
Coming up fast.
And what else? Is there anything else that we need to see or hear that has happened recently?
I just finished a project that I'm really excited about called The Seven Last Words.
Okay.
Based on the seven last words of Christ, which were the seven things that he supposedly said as he was dying. So, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. My Father, why have you abandoned me? I thirst. Mother, this is your son. Son, this is your mother. It is finished. Truly will be with me this day in paradise. And I'm forgetting one. But anyway, Joseph Haydn wrote a series. He was commissioned to write a series of sonatas based on each one of the seven words.
In wow.
In like 1780s. And it's super beautiful music. It's crazy beautiful. So I had this idea that, and it has always been performed in really interesting situations. Like the first time it was performed, it was at in Cadiz in Spain, where the bishop commissioned it, or somebody commissioned Cadiz. And what they did was they blacked out all of the curtains except for one, and they planned it so that when the bishop would come and read each word, there was a beam of sun coming straight at him from the roof, you know, like it was like, so it's like high drama performance since day one.
Wow.
And I'm really good friends with a string quartet in London, and they were telling me about this, and they were telling me that they wanted to record it anyway. And I was like, well, what if we like brought that performance to a different place? And so, but I didn't want to make, so the idea was to make seven films to go along with each of the sonatas and to perform it with the live string quartet.
Just a tiny little idea.
Yeah. And but I didn't want to do all seven myself because I thought it was really important, especially since it's such a Christian thing. I thought it was really important to get seven different filmmakers from different backgrounds, from different, you know, ethnic backgrounds, from different religions to you know, tackle these themes, because the themes are universal. They're not particularly Christian themes. The themes of abandonment, fear, distress, mortality, like that happens to everybody. And so, yeah, I wanted to get it out of the idea of Christianity, but keep this music. And so we got seven amazing filmmakers, and the movies were shot in Iran, Colombia, Haiti, Louisiana, in the north of Canada with Innu people, another indigenous filmmaker. It's kind of all over the place. And the films are really cool with no sound design other than the string quartet. And they go from pretty documentary-ish stuff, but like lyrical documentary, to extremely experimental films. And we had the avant-première in Montreal a few weeks ago with the string quartet. We flew them over from London, and it's awesome. It's so
cool.
Oh,
man, I wish I could have been there for that.
But the idea is whenever possible to play with the string quartet and not just the soundtrack, because it brings a whole different energy to the whole thing, because it's as much a concert as it is a film. And so it has that kind of sacred space of a concert, and where it could derail at any time. You know, like usually when you watch a movie, the movie's locked, it's done, the music's, it, you either like it or you don't. But there's this feeling with that live element that's like so thrilling, and also forces like a more intense viewing experience, because people aren't going to like cough and drop stuff and like eat popcorn in the same way, because there's like an incredible string quartet playing 20 feet ahead of you, you know?
Right.
And so I've never really seen a movie like that, where it had that feeling of like sacred music and then these images, which are, you know, very intense images from all these different minds and spaces and countries and cultures. I think I'm really happy about it.
Wow, that sounds awesome. I really can't wait to see that, and I want to experience it live and see. That is what is the gift of having these multiple disciplines, you know?
Yeah.
Because, which I imagine is, as it is right now, somewhat frustrating, at times, yeah, to feel divided between these two lives.
Hmm.
But the gift of that is something like that, where you're drawing that tension together for all of us to experience.
Yeah.
And have that moment of suspension.
Yeah.
In sound and in the visual.
Yeah.
Wow, that's super cool, Kaveh. Well, that was awesome. I think I'm going to call it.
Cool.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was really fun.